WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Luther King Jr. would have been 63 today. Many books have been written about his life and his place in the civil rights movement. Now his own writings are being made available for us to read. Historian Claiborne Carson is the director of the King Papers Project, which is publishing a projected 14-volume series of King's letters, student papers, speeches, and other writings. The first volume, Call to Serve, will be published next month. It covers his childhood in Atlanta, his 4 years at Morehouse College, and his studies at Crozier Theological Seminary. We invited Carson to share some of his thoughts on this volume and on the legacy of Martin Luther King. Carson is a history professor at Stanford University and the editor of a volume of Malcolm X's FBI files. Included in the first volume of King's papers is a religious autobiography King wrote while at Crozier Theological Seminary.
The autobiography is an extremely important document because it's an attempt by him at an early part of his adulthood to try to come to grips with why he became a minister. And he went through a lot of religious doubts to get there, so he talks about this. And I'll just read a couple of paragraphs. "My days in college were very exciting ones. As stated above, my college training, especially the first 2 years, brought many doubts into my mind. It was at this period that the shackles of fundamentalism were removed from my body. This is why, when I came to Crozier, I could accept the liberal interpretation with relative ease. It was in my senior year of college that I entered the ministry. I had felt the urge to enter the ministry from my later high school days, but accumulated doubts had somewhat blocked the urge. Now it appeared again with an inescapable drive. My call to the ministry was not a miraculous or supernatural something. On the contrary, it was an inner urge calling me to serve humanity. I guess the influence of my father also had a great deal to do with my going in the ministry. This is not to say that he ever spoke to me in terms of being a minister, but that my admiration for him was the great moving factor. He set forth a noble example that I didn't mind following. Today I differ a great deal with my father theologically, but that admiration for a real father still remains."
When King refers to lifting the shackles of fundamentalism, is he talking about his father's way of preaching and his father's religious views?
Yeah, the term fundamentalism, when referring to King Sr., though, was not truly accurate because he was a social gospel minister, as was King's grandfather. That is, King Sr. and A.D. Williams, the grandfather, were both ministers who combined their pastoring with political activism. Both were members of the NAACP, active in voter registration movements, active in various campaigns for equal rights. So I think what he was referring to more was the doctrinal conservatism of his father, and perhaps the emotionalism of the Baptist Church, which made him uncomfortable. He was looking for a more intellectually sophisticated religion. So what he was rejecting, he used the term fundamentalism to refer to.
Do you get any glimmers from his student papers of the political and social activism that was to follow?
Oh, definitely. He was a person who was quite concerned about social issues from an early age. We have a letter to the editor that he writes to the Atlanta Constitution in 1945, where he takes a stand against the racial murders that were occurring then. In his early college years, he's quite active politically. He's involved in interracial groups, which was definitely very unusual at that time. So I think that you always see that those political concerns going through even his theological papers. He'll make references at points to the way in which that shapes his religious views.
It has recently been discovered that some of the observations that King made in his student papers were actually lifted from other sources without attribution, leading to controversy over plagiarism. Were you the person who discovered this?
Yeah, that's not something that I hope to be remembered for a long time. I think it was something that we did come across in our research. But to me, the important thing was not so much the discovery would not have been so newsworthy if we had simply pointed out that throughout his life, King always used the ideas that he borrowed from other sources. And what made it perhaps a more controversial issue, of course, was that he was in an academic environment when he was doing it at Boston University. And there are very strict rules about plagiary there and at any academic institution. So I think that that made it controversial. But the more important biographical point to be drawn from it is that his skill as a thinker and as an influential leader was in taking ideas that he didn't originate and making those ideas into powerful ideas that could move people. And I think that doesn't justify certainly what he did in graduate school. But on the other hand, he wasn't at that point planning to be a leader. And I don't think that detracts in any way from what he did later in life.
Give us a sense of what exactly he did do. He didn't copy whole speeches and call them his own. What would he take a few lines from somebody else's text without footnoting it?
Yeah, it's we thought for a while about trying to find some metaphor that really expressed what he did, and perhaps the tapestry might be best. The way in which he wove together lines and passages from different sources, so that the end result was something that was very recognizably his. One of the things that is remarkable is that no one recognized this. His papers were obviously read by people. His dissertation was read by many scholars. None of them recognized that there were plagiarized passages. And I think the reason was that they saw the ideas that were being expressed as recognizably King's, that he was quite consistent in his theological viewpoint. So therefore, there was nothing that would have made them skeptical that this was not the work of the student.
When you discovered these bits of plagiarism, did you feel reflexively like you should cover it up at all? You know, like this wouldn't reflect that well on him. Maybe it would be better to not call attention to it. I mean, I think some people get very protective towards people whose papers they're keeping or whose biography they're writing.
Well, that might happen in some cases, but I think in my case, I don't think there was ever a question of covering it up. I think that maybe I just feel that it's better to know more, and that's almost a scholarly faith. And even if the more that you know is negative, it's better to know it. And I think that what did bother me was that it forced the project, the King Papers Project, to move in a different direction. That is, we had to spend countless hours tracking down all of these attribution issues. And all of that time could have been spent doing other things, but we knew that once we found it and once we had made that public, the question would become, how extensive is it? So we really had no choice but to spend that enormous amount of time.
What's coming up in the next volume of writings that you'll publish?
Well, actually, the volumes 2, 3, and 4 are in the works now, and Volume 2 covers his years at Boston University, including the dissertation, and Volume 3 is on the Montgomery bus boycott, and then the fourth volume will cover the late 1950s.
My guest is Claiborne Carson, and he's the director of the Martin Luther King Papers, and the first volume of his papers has just been published. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Claiborne Carson is my guest, and he has co-edited the first volume of the papers of Martin Luther King Jr., and he's the director of the papers. He's also the editor of a book on the FBI file on Malcolm X. You recently wrote that Martin Luther King's scholarship is moving away from hagiography and from the great man theory. When did that start happening, and why do you think it's important that the scholarship is moving away from that direction?
Well, I think that it's important because it's just not accurate to think of Martin Luther King as the person who made the movement happen. The important events of that movement would have happened even if Martin Luther King had never lived. The Montgomery bus boycott would have happened because he didn't initiate it. The sit-ins of 1960 would have happened. The voting rights movement in the Deep South would have happened. So all of that would have taken place. So therefore, you have to come to a new understanding of not him as this unchallenged leader with lots of followers, but rather Martin Luther King as one of those local leaders who emerge from the struggles of the 50s and 1960s. And because of particular talents that were unique that he had, he became quite distinctive in terms of his leadership. So I think that is important. Also, I think the notion that we rely upon certain great men, basically, they're rarely women, to bring about these historic changes is something that that takes away from the ability of ordinary people to change the world. Martin Luther King would never have had his opportunity to show his talents to the world if Rosa Parks had not acted first. So you have to balance this notion of a great person with the notion that the historical circumstances and the social movements of that person's time make possible opportunities for the great individual to fully develop and display their talents.
You foresaw King in 1963, the March on Washington. Would you tell the story of meeting Stokely Carmichael there and what he said to you about King?
Well, it was actually a few weeks before the march. I was at a student conference, and I met a number of the people who were in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, including Stokely Carmichael. And I recall I was an impressionable college freshman at that time, and this was my first venture into mass demonstrations. And he was referring to it as the Washington picnic and kind of putting it down and telling me if I really wanted to join the movement, I should go to Albany and the other hot spots in Cambridge, Maryland, and places like that. But I think for me it was a major step just to go to the march, I think only gradually did I really understand what Stokely Carmichael was talking about.
Were you ambivalent about King then, and did you agree with Carmichael's criticisms of him?
Oh, of course. I think any young black person during the 1960s would have had a certain amount of ambivalence. I mean, we all admired King. We all thought that he was a role model for what you could do with your education. But at the same time, there was always this skepticism about is nonviolence the right course? And you know, those were part of the arguments that made the 60s interesting. And I think have since kind of shaped my own thinking about the meaning of that decade. It's been a my scholarly career in some ways has been shaped by the effort to try to deal with the questions that were left unanswered by the 1960s, including where are we going and how do we get there, and maybe the most basic one of all of who are we as black people, because you can't decide where are we going until you decide that question of who you are.
What were the ways that you expressed your activism in the civil rights movement while you were in college in the 60s?
Well, I think I would best be described as a foot soldier, someone who was willing to go to demonstrations, occasionally get arrested, but not a not very much of a leader. A few times I gave speeches, but that I quickly recognized that that was not my real talent. And but someone who was, I think, quite dedicated to the idea of social struggle, but someone who was looking for the particular role that I thought that I could play best, and someone who also just didn't, you know, I admired these people who felt that they had the answers, because I looked at the movement we were in, and I never quite decided exactly what was the right strategy and what was the right ideology, and perhaps I still haven't quite decided that. I think I'm still trying to explore it, and that energizes my scholarship.
Do you still have the same questions or ambivalence about King now that you did when you were a student in the 60s?
I don't know if ambivalence would describe it as much as when I look at the African American experience, it is one of a group dealing with a historically unprecedented situation. You know, millions of people being brought involuntarily to another country, and then trying to find what are we going to do? How we can't go home again, and then we have these various leaders, King, Malcolm, many others, who have provided some insightful answers to those questions. And I find myself learning from each of them. I'm not one of these who says it has to be King or Malcolm. Mm-hmm. Why not both? I think both of them offer important insights for the present.
On Martin Luther King Day, I think it's interesting to ask the question, who are the most important leaders today in the African-American movement for equal rights, for economic rights, and so on? And I'm wondering what answer you'd give to that question.
Well, I think that in part, in answering that question, you look back to King and the role that he played, rather than seeing him as someone apart from a larger group of leaders. You would see him as one of many. And I think that today that's even more the case, that you're not going to get some preeminent individual who represents all black people. And that's part of the success of the past struggles. We have far more highly educated, articulate leaders on the scene at the local level. And these leaders are going to represent different points of view. I think that's very healthy. I hope that there continues to be debate. And I think that demand that somehow out of all of these, one leader emerge who represents the group is something that is not very healthy. So I think that we need to have that diversity, and that the kind of internal ideological debate that leads to some healthy conclusions and something that can guide us into the future.
What are some of the issues or ideas that you think it would be interesting for us to think about on Martin Luther King's birth date?
Well, I think that probably the most important thought is that Martin Luther King, to me, symbolizes the dissenting tradition in America. I think it's wonderful that we have a national holiday that is named for a person who is not a president and indeed never held a political office, but someone who nonetheless transformed American society and did it through protest and struggle. I think that that's a profoundly important tradition. When we think about what does it mean to be an American, what does the Constitution mean, all of that has been shaped and reshaped through countless struggles. The Constitution doesn't mean the same thing it did when the Founding Fathers drafted it. Black people weren't included in it. Women weren't included in it. Working class white men who didn't own property weren't included in that Constitution. All of that has come about because people struggled to make that possible. So I think that continuing struggle to define what it is to be an American, to define what our rights are, what our human rights and civil rights are, all of that is symbolized by King. So rather than spending the time just kind of thinking about the individual, I think we need to think about what that individual represented for us and the possibilities for this country.
I wonder if you feel a part of a political social movement today centered around African-American rights. If there's a movement you could really put your finger on the way you could the civil rights movement. Or well, if it's much more kind of spread out and hard to get a handle on.
It is kind of spread out. I think that the movement that I identify most with is the movement to define the American tradition in some ways. I think it's been variously referred to as multiculturalism, but I think there's lots of better ways to describe it. The way in which I would look at it is the demand for civil rights was a demand for that black people be included as equals in American society, but it didn't decide what kind of American society we would be part of, whether we would simply move into someone else's society or whether we would participate in defining that new society. And I think that that's the struggle that is going on now, and that's a very intense and very important and very extended struggle that will go on for a long time to define the literature of this country, to define the language, the music, to define every aspect of this nation and what it represents culturally and socially. And that's going to be a process that not only involves blacks and whites, but many other racial groups. And I think it's a very exciting process. I welcome it. I don't fear it. I think that this country has to learn to see its diversity as a source of strength rather than as a source of weakness.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
Claiborne Carson is directing the publication of Martin Luther King's papers. The first volume, Called to Serve, will be published next month by the University of California Press. King's birthday will be observed on Monday, and on that day we'll talk about the leadership and the issues now in the continuing movement for equality. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.